guys hear me?
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Well, now I got to say the whole thing again for the tape?
No, you had one of them on and the tape was going.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we'll call the conference committee to order. Let's just review the proposal that the Senate made. The proposal is dated April 9th, which was last Wednesday. It was intended to be a groundwork for a Friday hearing, which we had to cancel for weather-related reasons. It should have been ample opportunity for the House members to at least review what we put together in writing, and maybe we'll have some substantive discussion on it today. It follows the same form that our previous proposal did, so we'll just review it. On the first section, permanent catastrophe response codification versus 35W bridge-only compensation, the latest House proposal proposed a permanent change to the permanent tort liability statutes. There was some concern, particularly by the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, that making such a substantial change to the existing tort statutes without having a full opportunity for all of the stakeholders to be involved in that legislative process was not a very good process for that to take place. And the change that was made within the last several years, increasing the dollar amount of the caps, was a result of a lengthy and extensive process with negotiations among all of the stakeholders as well. There, I think, is a certain amount of sympathy toward the position that the House offered in terms of an ultimate change in the cap, without foreshadowing that, there was a great concern about doing that through a conference committee process when it wasn't part of either process that went through the House or the Senate for this particular bill and would end up not providing an opportunity for all the stakeholders, of whom there are many in this area, to be involved in the legislative process. But we also wanted to recognize the long-term consequences that what we do here will have. So what we proposed was less formal than a statutory change, but still formal action by the legislature, a statement of legislative intent, recognizing that, and this, I should note, was also a great compromise, particularly by Senator Betzold, who is notoriously opposed to legislative findings or such statements of intent. He's been consistent throughout his legislative career on that. A statement of legislative intent not codified, recognizing that the mechanism devised for compensating bridge survivors in this bill may be considered a template for future legislative response to an extraordinary event that occurs in Minnesota that causes large-scale injury or death, resulting in a legally viable allegation of state negligence. So we actually adopted a fair amount of the language from the House's proposal. However, we narrowed it a little bit. We did not use the term catastrophe because it has come to have sort of varied interpretations in various bills, including other legislation. I think that is going – oh, no, that's disaster is what they use there.
Yeah.
But what we've done, we sort of incorporated the definition rather than using a particular term. We simply call it an extraordinary event, which I think borrows the language from the previous House description. And we've narrowed it to injury or death, not physical infrastructure kind of issues, because the physical infrastructure stuff are things which are we have other mechanisms already in place, including the other legislation that I understand has moved off the House floor now, the disaster response bill. We also, in line with our discussions on the last conference committee meeting, narrowed it down basically to state negligent acts. First of all, we narrowed it to state action being involved, Representative Winkler had some comment about state action or inaction, not necessarily negligent conduct, and we felt it was important to keep it linked to negligent, or at least viable allegations of negligence. The second, Representative Winkler?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess to summarize, if you wanted to look at issue one, when we came in to this conference committee, based on the bills we had in both chambers, the House had a ongoing catastrophe fund section of statute that was codified with a lot of the substance of the bill contained in it. And at the last conference committee, we offered a pretty major concession in that regard, in which, because we, in addition to putting it into the tort context, we very narrowly limited the kind of ongoing statutory language that was there. And the Senate bill today essentially offers a non-codified statement of intent. And I just think I think we should be clear that on this issue that has frequently been described as one of the two major issues, the House has already offered a very major compromise. And the amount of give, I guess, on the Senate side is fairly limited in this first section anyway. And I just want to be clear on the record that that is not – that we didn't narrow it. The House conceded that in a proposal in the spirit of compromise.
Representative Winkler, I wouldn't say that the House conceded it. I would say the House reframed your original proposal to be within the tort liability statute instead of within a separate statute. But the scope of your proposal was this very similar, if not the same. The same type and scale as a natural disaster. So although you used terms of tort liability characterizing that, nothing in the details of your proposal narrowed what you had proposed at all. You simply cast it into a different existing statute is the way I interpret it. Certainly it was not anywhere near as significant a change as you're suggesting. You still use the term catastrophic events, even. Representative Kahn?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't believe I've ever seen a non-codified statement of legislative intent. Is there any other example of that in previous I don't remember it in the past 36 years. Does anyone have an example of it before that, or have I just forgotten one that maybe existed? And the other thing is, you know, we specifically, what's the reason for avoiding the word catastrophe? We specifically picked catastrophe because of the problem with using, we'd started using the word disaster. And the use of the word disaster got us into all kinds of other places where that was used. And I don't think catastrophe was used anywhere else in the statute. An extraordinary event seems, you know, an extraordinary event might just be, Pawlenty agreeing with Pogamilla could be an extraordinary event. And I don't think it
resulting
really
in large-scale injury or death. Probably.
It might, depending on what they agree on. But the I don't understand the reason. Well, first of all, the first question is there any other example in state history that one can come up with of a non-codified legislative intent? And then what? And what's the objection to the word catastrophe? Those are the two things.
Well, Representative Kahn, counsel might be able to assist here, but I think what we had intended by non-codified, was that it wouldn't become part of a permanent statute.
That's what I'm asking.
Legislative findings. We've passed bills here every year that don't become part of the statute, but still have the effect of law. We spend money sometimes for that purpose. We have findings that may or may not become, you know, part of a permanent statute.
Okay. I asked for was an example.
I can't think of one off the top of my head. Maybe counsel or someone else can. But I know I've been told that some of the stuff I was voting on in the past wasn't going to become part of a permanent
statute.
Appropriations
often don't and okay. Things like that. But I've never seen a legislative finding that was not, you know, and I don't pretend to know everything that's gone on around here. That's why I asked it as a question.
Well, and Representative Kahn, I mean, I think we can, I don't know that we're necessarily so far apart on what's intended there as maybe the description of it is non-codified. But I think we can certainly try to address that. The second part, in terms of catastrophe, I think we had some discussions as we were wordsmithing the term catastrophe as to what exactly that meant. For a one-person serious accident is a catastrophe for that person or for that family, even if it might not be a catastrophe in terms of statewide impact or anything like that. Our attempt was to avoid the ambiguity of that term and to simply describe what we intend for this to cover.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Solberg.
If something isn't codified in the statute books, then it still has a kind of the effect of law, but it's kind of tough to find. When I first came in 1983, I asked, why does one of my school districts have a primary? And because it was a little law passed in the law books of 72 or something like that that we could find. And it was tough to find. It seems to me that with the House proposal where it says specify that the new tort cap exception can only be invoked by legislative finding and specific appropriations is extremely important to have in the permanent record of the statute books. Otherwise, 30 years from now, somebody will be searching the session laws. And maybe that's a good thing for lawyers or lawyer clerks to do, but it seems to me it's a lot easier to found if it's in the book itself. I might be mistaken on that, but that's my history of that type of thing. That's the difference between session laws and the book, statute books. I might absolutely be wrong on it, but I think I'm correct.
Representative Kahn.
And then the final, I think you sort of misspoke on something on the House proposal, which says that this was that the exception we were making to the caps was an unlimited exception. Specifically, the second bullet point in the House proposal specifies that the new tort cap exception can only be invoked with a legislative finding and a specific appropriation. So it's hardly an ongoing exception to the tort caps.
Representative Kahn, I did not say or intend to say anyway that it was an unlimited exception. I did indicate it was a permanent exception to the existing story.
Okay.
It may have required, further action by the legislature. But certainly it was not unlimited in that regard. But that provision, if we go down by bullet points, I mean, that provision was in your previous proposal to be separately codified instead of within the tort liability statute as well. And so, as was the reference to the type of broad natural disaster references. So that's why we concluded that while we certainly appreciate putting it in the tort framework, that it was mostly a recasting of the same provisions within the tort liability laws instead of a substantive change in the proposed position.
Which we thought was a very significant move.
Well, it was. It was, but it was not as broad a change as Representative Winkler indicated, where he said completely, drop the entire proposal. I mean, you dropped the paradigm, which we appreciate.
Well,
was important to us, but the substance of the proposal was still very much. Unless I'm misreading your proposal, I'm happy to be reeducated on that. But it looked to me like the actual details of the proposal within the tort liability law was similar to what you had proposed before. I'm not belittling the significance of the change into the tort framework. We certainly do recognize that and appreciate that. But maybe enough said on that point. Senator Moy, I promised to come back to this provision, but we're still on this provision, so maybe Just on the first point, you had, in our discussions, you had expressed a particular concern about making a change to the existing tort liability statute without a process that allowed for input from all the stakeholders in that process. So that was the preface for my description of our proposal in Section 1. I don't know if you have anything you want to add in this point or if the topic comes back up, if you want to.
Okay.
On the next section, state tort claim limits, we have tried to make some to move toward the House in this, recognizing the concern that folks have for long-term health or medical coverage. Certainly, for those who are injured, that is a very significant, ought to be a very significant concern. It's been expressed by a number of the survivors who have testified. They're concerned about future medical expenses or uncompensated medical expenses. The information that we had received in our testimony was a bit ambiguous in terms of what was covered or not covered by medical insurance. We have since received some information from Mr. Messerly describing in more detail a few cases, anyway, of his clients, only one relating to an injured party and a party that had extraordinary medical loss within multiple members of the family, but indicated that he expected all or almost all of those medical expenses to be covered by insurance, is the information that we received. So at least until they receive their lifetime or hit their lifetime cap on medical benefits. So what we have tried to do here is to find a way to seamlessly bridge from for the survivors who were injured to seamlessly bridge from existing medical insurance coverage to long-term medical insurance coverage through an existing state program, MCHA, MCHA, or the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. We had some testimony from Lynn Gruber, their executive director, earlier in the conference committee process. I've had some follow-up telephone calls with her as well. And the details in the proposal here reflect those conversations and testimony. I should point out that for those, this would have two benefits. One is to make sure that no one goes into long-term personal debt because of uncompensated medical expenses. And second, because compensation from this fund would not have to be used to cover immediate extraordinary medical benefits, it would it could be used for a couple of purposes. One is to buy into MCHA, and or it could be used to offset past and future wage loss. So that is it goes at the toward the two economic loss categories that Representative Winkler indicated, and your last proposal indicated was the highest priority. If you're going to prioritize payments as between economic loss and non-economic loss, your proposal on April 7th was to prioritize full payment for economic losses, past and future, over non-economic losses. So this would address both of that. And I can review each line in detail. Maybe it's good to do for the public record that we would provide, the bill proposes administrative assistance to apply for seamless medical insurance coverage through MCHA. And I've specified administrative assistance here after my conversations with MCHA. Medica is apparently their administrator for the insurance program. To hire an ombudsperson, instruction to hire an ombudsperson to expedite applications and to follow up with administrative needs that make it easier for people accessing this program to have a person that is dedicated to facilitating their entry into and coverage by the program. You'll also notice that we propose a special appropriation to cover that. So the expense for that would not come out of either Medica's pockets or MCHA's pockets. It would be a specific benefit that would be provided through this compensation bill to the survivors. There were a couple of requirements that typically are prerequisites for qualifying for MCHA. One was that they be turned down for insurance in the private market, and we are proposing to waive that requirement. One is to smooth the process of investigating or determining whether or not the current medical coverage benefits limit has been reached. In my conversations with Ms. Gruber, it's while they make their best efforts, there is a lot of discretion involved in whether and how they go about making coverage retroactive to make sure there is not a gap in insurance coverage. So this would mandate that there's no gap. It would mandate retroactive coverage. Just provide it in there so that there isn't any effort on the part of medical providers or current insurance companies to play games with when coverage expires and the payment responsibility can be transferred over to MCHA, that there be some reasonable proof that the survivors have exhausted their private insurance benefits. And then there apparently also is a six-month residency requirement that applies to people who seek to qualify for MCHA, so this would also waive that residency requirement. So that we hope would provide, and our goal, certainly open to any other thoughts you have to smooth that process along, a goal to provide seamless medical coverage with no gap. Representative Winkler?
Senator Latz, I'm pretty sure I heard you. You said that this will avoid them taking on long-term debt for uncompensated medical expenses. This would not address past uncompensated medical expenses gaps that medical insurance that they already have don't cover, would it?
Representative Winkler, this proposal would not. The information that we have received so far is that there is very little existing uncompensated medical expenses. We even had testimony, I know, from Mr. Coulter on behalf of his family, and his testimony was that he had $500,000 or more in medical expenses. When we received the follow-up information, and in my conversations with Mr. Messerly as well, it was indicated that they expect, I think that was Blue Cross Blue Shield, to pay for all of the medical expenses. Most of the bills have already been paid. There are some substantial bills that are just taking time to process. They expect them all to be covered. Now, for individuals that have copays or have deductibles or those kind of things, that's the same thing that anyone who buys insurance has to deal with. You make your choices. You pay lower premiums. And you take higher deductibles or whatever trade-off you choose to make, and the people who made those choices would have to live with those choices. This would not create an incentive for people to opt for lower premium, higher deductible plans at all, or would not reward it anyway. I'm not sure what kind of incentives you can set in place in this kind of a context. But for those, most plans, they cap out at family maximums of, $5,000 or $10,000 a year or something like that, or deductibles in that range. The recipients here of the fund would still be fully eligible for their other cash compensation through this fund, which the Senate has proposed is up to $400,000. So that should easily cover any uncompensated past medical expenses.
And, Mr. Chairman, of course, the testimony we had regarding MCHA also was clear that this is more expensive, that future medical expenses only get covered at 80% of the total, that premiums are much higher, et cetera. So there still would be a significant economic loss if you have a serious condition that will require serious ongoing, whether it's therapy or other future surgeries, et cetera, that MCHA still only covers a portion of that. And so there will be future economic loss related to unreimbursed medical that still would not be covered under this. And if for those people who had damages or injuries significantly beyond 400,000, again, that wouldn't, this, the MCHA approach would not provide any kind of compensation for that. Those under the $400,000 cap likely could get full compensation for all out-of-pocket medical expenses.
Would you repeat that last? I followed you up until the last part of your...
Well, simply that the difference comes between whether you're above 400,000 or below 400,000 under this proposal. If you're below 400,000 and your total economic loss or out-of-pocket medical portion of economic loss, you're likely to get your full, you're likely to get full compensation for that, including future medical requirements, whether it be, you know, surgeries or therapy. So again, it creates this distinction.
Representative Winkler, that's correct.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, there's also, you mentioned here this residency requirement and state that current requirement is for residency for 6 months prior. What about people who move subsequently? Would your proposal anticipate having this follow them to other states?
Representative Winkler, I did not discuss that with Ms. Gruber from MCHA. I think we should probably get some information on what kind of coverage is involved for someone who moves out of state.
And finally, you know, Mr. Chair, I guess
Representative
if there's concern about a lack of legislative process related to changing on a permanent basis the tort cap system, it strikes me that this MCHA proposal is more complicated and certainly would be entitled to some of the same kind of process. And I don't know how we come to that without that same objection.
Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, I would raise another point for discussion because I think the points that you're raising is in the context of the Senate caps at 400,000. But I would also say that that's equally applicable under the House cap and the distribution of the funds. Because assuming that, let's say, somebody was eligible for about $800,000 in reimbursement, and they perhaps under the House proposal, they would get all of that $800,000 versus, say, they might be capped under the Senate proposal of $400,000. We're not going to propose to them that they can't go into MCHA, even though they got $800,000, right? And so I think that, you know, I had said this before when the representative from MCHA was here, that I think at the end of the day, whether we write them into the bill or not, regardless of where people are at in their individual circumstances and regardless of what the outcome is, MCHA is current law, and people could, regardless of what the amount of outcome they get, if they meet the requirements of MCHA, they'll go into MCHA, whether we all at the end of the day agree that they'll get $800,000 or $300,000, $200,000. So I think that the reference to MCHA, we should all think about not necessarily in the context of either the House proposal, the Senate proposal, the Senate cap alone, but I think we should think about it in the larger context of what the final outcome would be. And I would hope that this proposal is taken in that context, that it's not necessarily leveraged for either the House position or the Senate position, but that it's attempting to understand that at the end of the day we're going to have a bill, and whatever that bill looks like, we still have people who might need to be able to go into this program. So I just want to put that on the table.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, I agree with you. I guess I raised the points because if this is thought to be in some way an attempt to address people with economic losses far in excess of $400,000. My point is simply that this doesn't really, that this has limited value for medical expenses and for those who have the most severe injuries, and that the utility of including this is, I mean, it's a fine thing to do. It's a good thing to do, and it makes it easier. I understand all that. But if this in some way is supposed to offset the $400,000 cap by making the economic consequences less severe for the most severely injured, I think it has fairly limited value in doing that. That's the point of my comments.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, if you see it only in the context of this being somehow leveraged against the Senate cap of $400,000, then you could say that it doesn't have the value, because obviously I mean, we differ in terms of where we would ultimately end up at. But I just want to encourage all of us to think about it, not necessarily married to that context, because whatever the outcome is at the end of the day, given our limitations in this committee, I think that we still owe some kind of obligation to give some thought to the EMCHA. I mean, there's just no way that we don't have an open appropriation. We'll never be able to fully compensate people. And so we will have to look at alternative ways to give people multiple options. And so I just don't want this to be viewed as purely in the context of just the Senate numbers or the House numbers, but that this should, if this is important, we want to do it, we should think about it regardless of what the ultimate number is we end up at. The other piece of it that I want to touch base back on is that I've been asking about information, and if anybody who is listening to this conversation, who's in the audience, or maybe members of the committee know, if any of the survivors have actually busted their medical, you know, up to this point, if they've actually busted their medical limit and they have past medical expenses that are uncompensated up to this point, I guess I would like somebody to contact me individually or personally and let me know, because I'm the information that I've been hearing, not directly from people, is that none of the survivors yet are at that point yet, or that it is not anticipated they'll get to that point. But if somebody is, and I guess I would like to know, because it would be helpful to me as being a member of this committee. I don't want the lack of information for us to not be thorough in what we do, and I personally would appreciate the information.
And Senator Juan, follow up to that, just to clarify also for Representative Winkler, if anyone had the information that we have so far is that no one has exceeded their cap. But this proposal for EMCHA would mandate what is now a discretionary retroactive coverage, so that if someone hit their cap, you know, March 1st, but they apply for EMCHA in 4 months from now, EMCHA would be required to go back and cover their medical expenses between March 1st and that period of 4 months. So that, again, there would be seamless coverage for those medical expenses. I would also note that, Representative Winkler, you brought up the question of, yes, there would be people whose total losses were under $400,000 who would be fully compensated. But under the House proposal, which was a hard cap, as well, where they require for an ambiguous, equitable distribution of the funds within there, would by necessity require the panel of special masters to take money away from the less seriously injured persons and redistribute it to the more seriously injured persons. That's the only way that that fund could work. So you've spoken of what you believe is a community of interest, as if all 183 people who are on the bridge are coming forward in one voice and saying, we all wish to be treated the same. But I can tell you I have not received a flood of emails from people who are less seriously injured saying, I'm entitled to $250,000, but it's okay with me if you take $125,000 of that away from me and give it to someone else. But that's exactly what your proposal would do. So I don't think that it's fair to say that there is a community of interest speaking with one voice. I have heard from some of those who were injured on the bridge who disagree with the House proposal. I have heard from some who say they are not speaking with one voice. Some of them, frankly, have indicated to me that they're afraid to come forward because they would be viewed as not being part of the team. There is a group mentality that has coalesced apparently among those who have survived this, which is a good thing. It's a therapeutic thing, and it's healthy in many respects, I suppose. But I don't think that we can assume that they're all speaking to us with one voice. And I think the flip side of that question is, for those who are more seriously injured, are they here saying that they want to take that additional $125,000 from the less seriously injured group? Individuals. Or do they want to take the money away from them so that they can be, the more seriously injured group can be more fully compensated? I mean, that's the message that the House proposal is communicating. While the more seriously injured persons are certainly saying they think they should be fully compensated, that doesn't happen without less than fully compensating the vast majority of those who were injured on the bridge.
Mr. Chairman, right now there is no money. Nobody's taking from anybody else under either proposal because nothing exists without the bill. You can't assume an outcome and then say that there's a trade-off to be made and one person is seeking more versus another's and try to create divisions within the group. The question for the committee is what is the best way to distribute money to this group of people?
Well, Representative Winkler, you have already acknowledged repeatedly, as has the House conferees, that the House proposal would not fully compensate everyone for their losses. No, there is nothing right now. You are correct, but you're making a proposal. And under your proposal, the only way to get from A to C is through B. And that B requires reducing the compensation of those who would otherwise be fully compensated in order to more fully compensate those who are most seriously injured. And you've acknowledged that much on the record before. The question is taking Peter to pay Paul what Peter wants to do?
Mr. Chairman.
And you have proposed to be speaking on behalf of Peter, but I don't think it's fair for you to do that. Representative Solberg?
Now, you used a very important word in your statement, and that's more, because the opposite is also true. What you said was to get more down to those that are less injured, you have to take from those that are more injured. As you were speaking, I lost exactly how you used more in a sentence, but it was a striking word that came to me.
Representative Solberg, that's right, and that's existing law. The existing law is if your losses are under $400,000.
$300,000,
and we're proposing an increase it to $400,000, so even more people would be fully compensated. But that's the consequence of existing law. This legislature has made that policy a long time ago. Representative Solberg?
Well, that's. I'll stop now. I disagree with you wholeheartedly.
Why don't I finish my Representative Kahn?
Let me point out, too, that one of the other things that we haven't gotten to talk about, I don't think I see it in the Senate offer at all, is that we also have a disagreement as to what the total amount is. And the House more is more than the Senate more.
The total grant?
Yes.
Representative Kahn, that's correct.
Except for the thing in the Senate, the thing where you can come back to the legislature in the future, which we have a lot of problems with.
Well, Representative Kahn, you'll note two bullet points down from where I stopped describing it. We address that issue of finality that there seemed to be consensus on both sides of the conference committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Solberg.
Can I ask where the additional cost for the add administrative assistance for MSHA would come from? Would that be another taken out of the $25 million or the $40 million? Because obviously there has to be a cost or for that particular service to hire an ombudsman.
Representative Solberg, that's a fair question. Our proposal was to increase the appropriation to cover that additional cost, so it would not come out of the amount of money set aside to compensate the survivors.
And do we have a cost of that?
I had asked Ms. Gruber from MSHA to get back to me. She anticipated probably a half-time person would be involved in this, but she has not gotten back to me with a specific dollar amount to be proposed.
Yeah.
But it would be our proposal to increase the Senate's number to account for that. So there'd be no change in the amount of money set aside for the victims or the survivors, as we are now.
And Mr. Chairman, just another fiscal thing. What is when you waive the private market turndown and waive the 6 months? What does that cost to the MSHA program itself? Do we have that? I mean, it has to be some kind of a cost to it when you change that particular program, because there's a six-month rule, but there's at least 6 months of premium. It may not be total costs, but it should be, as you spread it out over all the recipients of MSHA, but are we intended to have a special appropriation to cover that cost as well?
Representative Solberg, this is not intended as a permanent waiver of those provisions, just a specific waiver for this particular group of
applicants. Mr. Chairman, I understand that, but I'm asking, that's a cost to waive those particular possession of the current law, the 6 months. Is that going to be an additional cost that the Senate's bringing forward, additional appropriation? Are we expecting the recipients of MSHA right now to bear that cost?
Representative Solberg, as the recipients of MSHA always pay premiums to help cover the costs of the entire pool, this applicant pool will be absorbed into MSHA in that respect. We don't know at this time if there is any one of the group of survivors that would even need to take advantage of this particular provision. We don't know if there was someone who had only lived here for 1 month. But on the other hand, we all know that they were at least in Minnesota last August 1st. Whether they were their permanent residency was in Minnesota, I don't know if we have any specific information on that or whether they still reside in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, there's three waivers you have. Waiver of private market turnout, so that's a change from current law. Mandatory retroactive coverage, that's a change from current law. And waive Minnesota residency requirement, that's a change in current law. Somebody that's in MSHA administration or somebody someplace should be able to tell us what the anticipated cost of that is. And then we need to know if that's it may how much it is. It might not be much, but whether then we're going to have that spread out over the recipients of MSHA, that's a decision we can make. But or if you want to make a special appropriation, I think we should understand that there is additional costs there.
Representative Solberg, as we've talked about before, anyone that would otherwise qualify can apply to MSHA.
Yes.
And they're accepted, then those costs get spread out over the existing MSHA members. So I don't know that there would be necessarily any way to quantify this unknowable question right now. But the Senate's proposal was for MSHA to simply absorb this in their actuarial forecasts as they do whenever they receive new applicants. But this would at least smooth the way for them to get into MSHA. Representative De La Forest.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. If you could help me understand the MSHA component, I assume whatever the number is, we're assuming there will be increased costs, obviously. And they would be borne then through higher premiums by those who contribute? Is that how the scheme would work?
Senator Shunk,
help me understand.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, MSHA is also funded by an assessment on the fully insured market. So it's a combination of premiums paid, and I think the premiums are 115, 100 and some percent of a typical.
It's now at 119%.
Is it 119%? So the premiums are higher, but I also think that we're talking, I mean, we don't even know if we have anybody that would be in this position, let alone a large number of people. I don't foresee that myself, just from what we've been able to gather in the way of information. But you know, and I think from time to time the legislature has made appropriation to MSHA to help out with that, with the deficiency in terms of what, you know, I think the information says that well, there's a figure in here for they were 120 million or something. Yeah, plan losses. I mean, 2007 claims and administrative fees will exceed plan revenue by about 120 million 900 and some thousand. That's significant. and I think from time to time we have, but not often, but sometimes we have. And I'm not suggesting we do that, but I think it's pretty minimal here in terms of the number of people that would be.
Representative De La Forest, our fiscal projections were that there are about 12 individuals who would be in the catastrophic physical injury loss category from the bridge collapse.
Mm-hmm.
All of the other physically injured persons, we project anyway, would be able to fit within the $400,000 Senate cap, proposed cap on payments. So for that category of 12, is really, or approximately 12, because we don't know exactly the extent of everyone's injuries and whether or not they're going to hit their lifetime benefits cap either.
Right.
This would, actuarially, it's a very small number compared to the number of people in MCHA, which in my recollection is about 35,000 policyholders right now.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, I understand that we're still trying to wrap our arms around some of the statistics with respect to the MCHA proposal, and so that's a reserve further judgment until we can get a better handle on some numbers and find out exactly who may qualify, who's eligible, and what some of the numbers may be and how they'd be spread around the pool. I just think it may raise a question for me sort of fundamentally about who would pay, you know, if it's going to be an assessment to MCHA, if there needs to be a supplemental appropriation. I think it just begs a larger question that we wrestle with at this table about how costs should be spread out and who should bear them. For example, as I said, I just reserve judgment on that and keep an open mind until we see some numbers.
Senator Moore.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I have the same questions that Representative Solberg had in terms of the three waivers that are in our provision. I'm in agreement with him to the extent that maybe if we could ask the MCHA people if they could maybe do some guesstimates for us or, you know, get some information to us on those three provisions, keeping in mind that whether we choose to exercise to put the waivers into statute or not, these people, regardless of the outcome is, if people hit their limit with or without these waivers, they're still going to go into the MCHA program. So unless where we want to get to is that, you know, as a committee, if we say we've made a decision that this is how much we're going to give out to the families and then we're going to explicit prohibit participation in AMCHA, which is I don't think we're going to go there. So as I mentioned before, I think questioning the sort of the additional add-on in varying from current law is, I think, the responsible thing to do, and I'd like to know what that information is. But at the end of the day, I think that we're not going to prohibit anybody from participating in AMCHA, particularly this group. And so I don't know that I don't think that it's not the AMCHA program itself. It's at discussion. It's really the waivers and how much more expensive it's going to be. And I think it might – if it's marginal, I don't think it's that big of a deal. But if it's a really, you know, big deal, I think that then it does behoove us to think about whether or not that's the appropriate direction to go. But I would just hate for us to not think it through. And then, you know, if there's one person who is kind of caught in that bind and we had the ability to make it work for them and we didn't, that would be too bad.
I'm not sure that we're necessarily going to be able to have all the information necessary here either unless we contact the known eight and the mythical four in the catastrophic injury loss category and find out, have you lived in Minnesota for the last 6 months as your permanent residence, you know, have you applied yet for private market insurance, which, frankly, with these kinds of injuries, they're going to get turned down in the private market. It just saves them having to go through the administrative process of making that application. So we may not be able to access the precise information we're looking for, except that we've got a projection that we're dealing with about a dozen individuals. The next bullet on this bullet point was that the special master panel must make some payment on all claims to meet the criteria for damages, loss, and survivors definitions. So that was in response and essentially adopting the House proposal in that regard to make sure that those who have maybe minimal physical injury and don't have any medical expenses that weren't covered but have more significant psychological loss, that they at least would get some payment. But then sets the priority out with economic loss first and then non-economic loss. And this, I tried to just write down the substance of our conversation around this table last time in that regard, so that when only non-economic loss was suffered, then some payment must be made on the non-economic loss, meaning they may have suffered an injury and therefore qualified to apply under tort law for compensation, but not maybe they didn't miss work as a result and they didn't have any unpaid medical bills that would otherwise amount to economic loss. Then we're saying that the panel must at least make some payment on the non-economic loss component, but leaving it up to the individual situation and the panel member, the panel and the individual claimant to determine, you know, what the scope of each category is for payment. There are a variety of consequences, including tax consequences, to how settlements are reached or what portions of settlements are paid for in which categories. And I don't think we want to get involved in those discussions, but those are best left to individual claimants and their lawyers and the special master panel.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
We've now brought in the special master, and I guess as I look at the major issues that we have to address, the ones that follow aren't big differences. Maybe we've talked through some of them. Some of them are more technical. What I don't understand is where the Senate has significantly moved off of its original bill. I could go through a pretty solid list of things that the House has proposed, including ones that you adopt here as though they're the House position, that were not in the House bill and have been offered in with an attempt to compromise. And I, rather than going through the rest of the list in detail, I guess I would be interested in what the Senate sees as major or significant offers thus far, concessions that differ from the original Senate bill.
Well, Representative Winkler, we're kind of working our way through this, but the original Senate bill said nothing about MCHA. It simply capped things at $400,000. And so all of the language here relating to MCHA is a significant departure from the original Senate bill. We did not have any formal statements relating to the future effect of what is done here, and we are proposing to have a formal statement regarding the future effect. That's in our first section. We were trying in the original Senate bill to deal solely with the to keep the bill narrowly focused on these individuals that would claim from the bridge collapse, and let future legislatures and history record what precedent was set. But here we are conceding a point that was apparently important to the House to make a specific statement regarding the future effect of what we do. So that is significant. We've come to accommodation on the special master panel in terms of the appointment process and
the Senate
timing.
Position.
No, it seems to me that the House was concerned about who exactly would make the appointment. That seemed to be a pretty significant consideration, and we've come to the middle in that regard. We had the situation where the House had proposed to have parties involved in the appointment process, neither of whom wanted to be involved, the governor's office and the attorney general. So I don't know that it's a surprise that the House moved off the mark to take them out of the process when they didn't want to be involved in the process in the first place. You desire to have the entire Supreme Court make the decision, we didn't have any problem with leaving it up to the Supreme Court to decide how they wanted to do it. So I think we reached mutual accommodation on that process. You were more concerned about finality of this. Senator Moy had some concerns about that, too. But the Senate bill specifically left things open, stated it was our intent to fully fund the settlement. When the House, Representative Kahn and Representative Solberg made specific, very strong statements about wanting this to be the final statement on this and not leave the door open for having to come back. So we have found common ground on that as well. And we didn't get to that bullet point, but it does say explicit language requiring special master panel to make distribution decisions with the understanding that no future appropriation will be available. So that's a significant move, I think, as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Solberg.
That's only a significant contribution or movement to the House position if you also then include the $40 million in the appropriation of the House.
Representative Solberg, the $40 million House appropriation was premised, we've tried to get our arms around exactly what it was premised upon. We've heard, I think, at least several different explanations from the House members as well as from other parties outside of this room as to how that $40 million was arrived at. But the Senate had a very disciplined process for coming up with its dollar figure,
Mr. Chairman.
Solberg.
Dart
was
the board.
What's that, Representative Winkler?
Sorry, I was speaking to myself.
But we came up with our principles for how we were going to approach the bill, and then we simply tried to calculate based on those principles what the total dollar amount would be.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Solberg,
that probably wasn't the case when you had in your language that the next legislature could appropriate more money.
No, Representative Solberg, it simply reflected that we couldn't predict the future with complete certainty. And so in the event that our calculations were off a little bit, we left the door open because it was our intent to fully fund the settlement within the parameters that were defined in the bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't recall that it was your intent to fully fund when you had language that said the next legislature could fund more. What I'm contention is that there has been some additional work done in the House and the governor's office, working closely with the governor. So in the House of and the Department of Finance. What I'm saying only specifically is that the appropriation is enough to cover the full settlements is a matter of schematics of which is the right amount of money to be able to compensate. And obviously the first thought of the Senate was that the $25 million wasn't enough because you allowed for more appropriations to come in.
Mr. Chair.
So. Representative Solberg, that was not a fair characterization of the Senate position, which we have expressed a number of times here at the table.
Mr. Chair, there's a call of the House. I would just say that the...
Representative Winkler.
Thus far, the House has offered to move completely off of its framework of a compensation fund born out of the general duties of the state and moved into a tort compensation scheme. We have substantially eliminated the ongoing nature of the compensation fund with the special master panel and all of the various provisions that were included in Article 1. We have essentially adopted the Senate position on the special master. We have clarified the House position that the aggregate $40 million cap is a hard cap and that we do not wish the special master to make any payments, assuming that there will be more money available. And we have offered all of these concessions thus far. And I frankly don't see a lot of interest in the Senate in compromising from their positions in the bill on any of these major items. And I don't think the House is in a position to respond with another offer to this one because I think we are already negotiating with ourselves. So I think that the House is under call. We need to leave in order to go and check in and vote. But I don't know what further we can accomplish unless there is more of a willingness to compromise on both sides.
Well, we're already having a walkout by the House members at some point.
The House is under call, Mr. Chair.
All right. We'll see if you wish to come back, Representative Winkler. We'll be waiting.
Are we in recess?
We are in recess.
Okay.
My yes.